fast. Real slow. The dreams come soon. The dreams soon go.
Les McCann with River High, River Low. It's the title track on his 1976 album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, March the 17th. And Q's life still matters. A family's quest for justice in a police killing. As usual, Lasana Daspora had his day planned. He was well on task on November the 7th, 2014, when toward the end of the day, he received a message every parent dreads getting. His 20-year-old son, Sinkyu, also known as Q, was dead, shot by a local Jackson, Tennessee police officer. That's what Lasana was told. The details were sketchy, but Q was gone. Lasana went numb, way beyond the point of pain. But there was neither time nor space to deal with the brutal reality that now was thrust upon him and his family. Got to get to Q, was all he could think. Got to find out why he's dead. Lasana Daspora shares the agony of that moment and the months since then in the first of four in-depth conversations we will have with him about the death of his son at the hands of police, about the wall of resistance, misconduct, and corruption he has encountered in trying to discover the truth about the shooting, about the predatory interests of lawyers and so-called leaders seeking to exploit these kinds of cases for their own agendas, and about how his fellowship with others whose loved ones also were wrongfully killed by police has inspired a new mission and purpose in his life. And I welcome you, Lasana, to Lead Stories today. Thank you for being with us.
Hello.
Yes, thank you for being with us today, Lasana, and welcome to Lead Stories.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, I know this is a painful task, but I would like you to know how appreciative I am of the offer that you have made to allow us into this part of your life and that of the family as it continues to grieve over the passing and the death of your son. November the 7th, 2014, you began the day going about your business. Tell us what happened that day.
Interesting thing about the day of my son's death, or execution as I call it, it was fairly routine. The slight exception that I made was instead of going straight back to our place, my son and I, Q, live together. I did divert, as I do sometimes, maybe to go to the store, grab something, you know, for dinner, something to eat. And so I took that diversion then, and and during that time, of course, I would come to find that was during the time which this whole episode occurred, and my son ultimately ended up lying face down on the ground and being shot in the back by Jackson, Tennessee police. On the way back, there had been a major diversion of traffic, and got caught in that, had been trying to reach my son, as his mother had as well. And, you know, with every moment that it went on without being able to reach him, and that traffic diversion being right in the area of where we lived, you know, just heart just sank a little more. But that is how I kind of frame that episode, just that going to get something to eat and just taking those extra hour and a half or extra couple of hours before getting back other than that, I have no doubt that my son would still be alive.
Could you tell us about this place you lived in, Jackson, Tennessee? How did you, were you born and raised there, or did you go there purposefully to live?
Purposely. I'm from the Chicago area, Gary, Indiana. It's where I was born and raised, and actually where Q grew up as well. How we come to be in Tennessee, or I describe it, Utrice, very frequently and accurately, I think, as the Jackson Madison County plantation. My son's mother and I, we split at some time, unfortunately, and I say that because I know my son was very unhappy with that. I was always very close with CinQ. CinQ and I were very, and it still are, in spirit, very close. So I was going to be where my son is, you know, regardless of what is the relationship between his mother and I. And I will say that we have always remained very close and tight regarding our son. But that is how I came to be in Jackson, Tennessee. Had been here just about 4 years. At the time of Q's execution here.
And what was your impression of Jackson, Tennessee?
Jackson, Tennessee has several decades at least to catch up to the 21st century in terms of the social political environment and the dynamics. Day-to-day dynamics between the various communities here. It is very, very much in the mode of what I call a plantation. And by that, I simply mean that, yes, this is a place, despite being 50% Black African-American, it has all the earmarks of a place where whites are dominant. Whites are what you see and who control largely the economic power bases, the media, and law enforcement, as we've seen in a number of communities of late, seems to be an arm of that interest of maintaining a superior position for whites in this community and maintaining a subordinate position for people of color and Blacks in particular, who I say are virtually 50% of this population. Jackson is very much still rooted in some of that antebellum culture here, and it's reflected in many, many ways, and including how we see law enforcement and some of the consequences that we see when Blacks, particularly young Black males, encounter law enforcement in this community.
But still, you lived there. I have to ask why.
Well, one, as I said, my son did grow up in what was my hometown as well. But as I said, when his mother and I split, she was working here. She's employed here now. So he was finishing school here, high school here. And so rather than, you know, another interruption in that, because I should say CinQ was not enamored with the place either. Neither of us were. And that was part of what we were kind of working our way toward. But in the meantime, yeah, he had finished up high school here. We did what we intended as a gap year, which is something that more high school graduates are doing now, taking that gap year in between high school and starting college. So we were still here for, I guess it would be roughly it was 2 years at that point since Q's graduation. He graduated in 2012. And yeah, that was our plan. We were intending planning on going back to the Chicago area.
Tell us about CinQ.
CinQ, who we call Q. He's been known as Q since his earliest days. Cinque was named, first of all, for the hero of the Amistad. And if you know that story, Singbe Pie, which was his African name, it got corrupted into what we know as Cinque. Cinque actually bears both names, Cinque, and his middle name is Singbe. Was a very, very endearing spirit, intelligent young man. Cinque was very creative, positive energy, unassuming. Most folks who know Q, and most of them who knew him through me, because Cinque was always with me, and whatever I was doing, it was my activist work, grassroots work, work out in the community, media related. They often saw Q with me. That's how a lot of folks got introduced to him. So Cinque had aspirations himself for writing. He was a writer. He was an avid reader and writer, and he translated that into his interest in gaming. Since he was a very avid gamer, and as a matter of fact, that most recently is what he was doing academically. He was just a few weeks into an online game design program that's offered through MIT, he had spent a couple of summers preparing himself for that in some digital design camps in the Chicago area. But he was traveled. I always doted on the fact that by the time Cinque was 11 or 12, he had been around the world, you know, where his father, you know, really hadn't been out of, you know, too far out of, you know, the neighborhood at that age. So we had some opportunities to travel, Cinque was very interested in other cultures. He studied Japanese, very interested in Japanese culture, particularly, you know, hence the interest in anime and gaming, you know, especially. He was an honor student pretty much throughout his academic experience. Kind of, like I said, unassuming. A homebody to a large extent. Cinque was not one to kind of run out for, you know, every little party or social event. He was not very materialistic. I would say if we had to ask him, you know, we'd never give Cinque anything, because he would always say no. And he was, I observed that he was very generous with his cousins and so forth, and sharing and giving to them. But himself, he was not a very materialistic young man, not raging after all of the latest technical gadgets or Nike, you know, footwear, all that kind of stuff. That wasn't Cue. Very, very, very simple. And a very good person, really was intelligent and creative. My best friend, well, I always called him, really, I teased him, called him my favorite son, since he was my only son and my only child. And he would, you know, call me his best friend. But, yeah, I was very, very close to my son, and I still feel it.
What were you hoping for him, and what was he hoping for himself?
Like I said, he was very, very much into the gaming. He was part of the online gaming community, and the one thing that I always talked to him about, just as he was reading and becoming a writer, as he was coming up, we always had discussions about, you know, look for a niche to where you can introduce more into whatever it is you're doing of that's derived from, you know, your cultural heritage or whatever, because there's a need for more of that. So I always tried to introduce him to that in reading and writing. So in terms of gaming, that's what we were looking at, and that was the hope, to see him be successful in that, but also to go in and carve out a niche that would bring to that venue more for young men and women of color to see of themselves in those characters and in those programs and that genre of entertainment. That's what we were hoping. So I wanted to see him be successful in that, and I had no doubt that he would be, because he had a a lot of experience in it, some training in it. As I said, they went back some years already, and this was his entree into preparing himself to do that professionally, starting with that that program.
It's a painful exercise, but to the best of your recollection, could you walk us through the exact moment that you got the news that this dreadful thing had happened? And could you retrace what you did when you got that news?
Well, yeah, you should say that. That's interesting because you can I can take that on in a couple of ways. In that I stress that my son and I are very close, and I can say this without going in a lot of detail, but before I got to my place and to the scene because Weston Key was executed, was really just on the outside of the perimeter fence from where we actually lived. But on en route back, and as I said, you know, us realizing that something was wrong, I got a very strong sign that I know now, I understand now, was actually from Q. His spirit had moved on. And it just some time later, I guess it would have been, I don't know, maybe within an hour or so, by the time I get there, you know, then when the police are there, and then the episode at the hospital, which I'll share some detail with you a little later, and when someone actually finally said something definitely. But you know how you, by that time you already know. And then, of course, I had that spiritual sign from Q earlier. So and that was en route back to my place when I got that. But by the time I got something just hard and fast and official from them, I think it might have been maybe roughly an hour or something later, and not in under very good circumstances at all. It's that visitation or that sign that I got from Q and kind of receiving at that point was helpful, because the circumstances under which I got official and word wise from the police there, it was under very very bad, very hostile circumstances. It was a challenge to keep myself together, given what I encountered from the Jackson police at the hospital.
Okay, but tell us as detailed as you can and can recall the kind of timeline, minute by minute, as you recall it. You told something dreadful had happened. Who told you this, and then what did you do?
Well, again, Yatrice, keep in mind, I pretty much have that sense already, and I've had this sign from my son. So when I get home, I'm not in there very long. There are two or three police cars parked out in the driveway out in between where all of the units are. We live in a kind of condo complex. And they were there. They didn't approach me or anything as I got in, but I was in the house for some minutes before a knock came. And of course, you know, you already know what you know, sense what you sense, and you open the door, and you know, there's a crowd of policemen at the door. And at that point, they were just simply saying, they're trying to confirm that Q lived there or was my son or whatever. And once that was established, it indicated, you know, me being needed at the hospital. And so I, made my way to the hospital. And it was almost from the moment I set foot, which was just slightly ahead of the officers, because I didn't drive with them. They offered. I went separately. Just steps behind me I call it a gang, and I mean it was a gang of white policemen who immediately, with one lead officer, just began to obstruct and block my progress, and block my ability to talk to even so much as a receptionist at the hospital. I had just barely gotten enough of a signal from her where she was, you know, trying to identify who I was kind of coming to see, and she had kind of pointed in a certain direction and saying, oh, you're talking about the person back there or something like that. And at that point, bam, it was just like the hospital was commandeered, even at the receptionist desk. She totally went dummied up on me, so to speak. Standing right there, still trying to have a conversation, ask questions, nothing. And because they are swarming around me. And then as I try to make my way back, they are physically, and I mean physically, you know, body blocking and bumping me and keeping me, from getting back to the area, that she had indicated. And, you know, it's the kind of thing, you know, if that had been, you know, me on the street or someone bumping into an officer, you know, they'd be ready to take you down and claim assault. But this is what I was encountering in trying now, to get back there.
You are the next of kin. You are the aggrieved father coming in, presumably,
yes,
at this time.
Yes.
Were you aware that, were you told that Q was dead, or were you told that he was simply at the hospital and you were hoping to see him? Were you aware at the time that in fact he had passed away?
Not from them. You know, I told you I kind of had my sign from my son. In another way, but not from them. And to be honest, I can't remember the exact moment that might have been communicated to me. But I know that it was a while that I'm trying to get back there, trying to, you know, just see where my son is, and see, you know, and hoping against hope, because even though, you know, I'd had that sign, you still just hope, you know. Well, maybe, maybe. I don't remember exactly when they communicated that, but I remember this very well, Utris, when I did finally get that, and then asking, you know, what, how, you know, where is he shot? I remember this very well, this officer, you know, right in my face, you know, telling me directly that he was shot in the chest, you know, and leaving it at that, yeah.
Did you know further any other details other than your son was in the hospital, he was shot? Do you know any details about the circumstances yet as you get into the hospital? Or was it simply about confirming whether he was still alive or had died?
No, I didn't know anything else at that time, and didn't know even what I thought I knew based on, you know, the lie that the policeman told me. So no, not any details. Just you know, as you're kind of making through the diverted traffic and whatever, you know, or sometimes, you know, other travelers, you know, kind of talk. You know, I heard there was you know police shot somebody or whatever, or you know, but yeah, you know, nothing, you know, nothing more than my son was there. And, you know, like I said, I already had this sense that, that my son was gone.
Did anybody from the hospital, other than the police and the scant information that you had as you entered the hospital, trying to get your way to see your son, did anybody from the hospital come to you and in a way to give you from their perspective what was going on with your son?
No. And as a matter of fact, what I figured out later, clearly what they were trying to do was trying to keep me as far away from that as possible. That's what they were doing. They were trying to get me to go, you know, somewhere else, you know, kind of, you know, lay down another quarter or something or whatever, you know, and just be out of the way of what they were doing and what they were trying to cover up. So it's sometime later before I see anybody else. And when I finally speak with somebody, you know, the ME, well, there's all kind of questions about, you know, their handling of the scene there. So, yeah, the short answer to your question is no. And clearly what I recall about hospital personnel, and this raises a big question for me, too, is just how whether intimidated themselves by the site or on site of it, or just whether they had already been informed, because obviously they had been there before I was, you know, the police with the in the hospital, signaled or told one way or another to, you know, stay back, stay away, you know, don't say anything or whatever, because that was what I got. It's almost like I felt like I was in a cage when I got up there, because here I'm surrounded by this gang of white policemen, and it's just like the medical people almost kind of like, you know, on the other side of a cage that I'm in, and we can't engage each other. That was the sense. That was very definitely the sense.
Was there a person who was designated, you know, in situations like this of intense grief, but it's also a very tragic situation, and to a degree, one could appreciate that if it was in fact involving a police officer, that there would be a lot of brass around. But just the same, you're describing a scenario of hostility, if I could use that word. But was in all of this, was there anybody who was a designated person on the part of the police to come to you as the father of Cinque, to tell you personally exactly what you were walking into, what had happened, and why you're there?
Well, I would figure, Eutrice, that among, you know, that gang of policemen that I was encountering, that there was someone who maybe that would have that role. But what I'm saying is how this played out for me is that is not what was happening. I could probably point to a couple of people who you might have thought under certain circumstances that maybe that's what they were going to do, but nobody was doing that with me. And like I said, it didn't take long to really understand, but they're definitely trying to keep me from something. And I understand that, you know, very shortly to be, you know, an attempt to cover up something. No one approached me or dealt with me in quite the way that you're talking about, and in quite the way that, yes, I would expect, myself. And likewise, you're talking about the police, but even just there in the hospital, you know, I mean, the police don't suddenly own or commandeer a hospital and, you know, basically put all of the medical personnel on lockdown. You know, it's not like you got a hostage situation or something like that, but that's what it was like more so than a situation where you get medical people coming to talk or, you know, inform, as well as whatever these law enforcement, have to say to the parent at that time. It was not that kind of scene. Hostile is very much the term, Eutrice, and maybe an understatement, but yes, it was a hostile environment for me.
All the while you are dealing with this, are you alone, or is there someone with you who can help you, who can brace you for the moment, somebody you knew, somebody you were connected to, or were you dealing with this all by yourself?
Physically, I was the only one. Again, what kept me together, it's interesting, is what has kind of always kept me together is I've kind of, in a number of ways, kind of battled on behalf of my son, you know, since his childhood. And one thing that that always kept me holding myself together is, you know, the awareness that, you know, if I lose it, that's an excuse for them to really take me out of a position to do what I need to do for my son. So that kind of thing, you know, kind of keeps me together. But no, there wasn't anyone else there, because I went as soon as I understood that I needed to get there. His ma, as I said, both of us, you know, pretty kind of already having a sense of what may have happened, you know, just wasn't inclined. I was the one to go and, and see to things there, and then, you know, communicate with her.
So in all of this, when was the moment that you saw for yourself, or you were able to determine for yourself and confirm for yourself that your son was in fact dead?
Well, as I said, there was that obstruction that went on for some time to when finally this is what they do. Explain, okay, well, we're just going to have you kind of look through the window. You know, you can't go in the room and you have a curtain drawn. They when I got to that window, that's all it was. They had a curtain drawn around his body because, again, remember, you know, they're hiding something that I'm not going to find out till later. And all I can see is basically just torso from basically just right up around the shoulders to his head. And a tube that I think they put in his mouth at that time to, you know, for to give the impression that, you know, there had been what they were doing was, you know, making an attempt to save him. Again, I based on what I learned later, excuse me, I think that was, you know, also just staged. But yeah, it was then. So when I finally get to see, and you know, and that's you know, it's that was my son. And, you know, so I just can't.
Are you there? Okay. Lasana, are you there? Okay. There is a silence, because there is a silence, and I could imagine how difficult it is to go through this, and we don't know what happened on his end, but I'm imagining that he's having a little difficulty recalling the moment. So what we've learned so far is that this father and son were kind of a team in life. They had lived together and they were very close to each other. The call comes, he is abruptly and unexpectedly told of this major, major, major disaster, a catastrophe in his life. And he's walking us through the experience, the initial experience, and what we're getting is an appreciation of sometimes how people, you can't possibly be prepared for something like this. But this is what happens sometimes in life. And the cases that we get to know about, we deal with them on a theoretical level. We're getting an appreciation of what happens in real time. This is what a person is experiencing at a moment that nobody ever wants to experience. You cannot imagine, you cannot predict how you would react or what will...
Hello?
Yes, I'm glad that you're back with us. We lost you there for a moment.
Okay.
So I'm recalling for the audience the fact that we are appreciating through your pain again, and I thank you for that, of recalling a moment nobody wants to recall. Nobody should really have to recall. And the circumstances in which you found yourself, and now you have to deal with life occurring at 100 miles an hour, coming at you, all these things that you have to deal with all at the same time and make sense of a very surreal situation. You were describing, we lost you just as you were describing, looking from behind a curtain at this body that is now on a gurney, and what is going through your mind?
I'm looking at my son. I guess at the same time, you know, at one level, understanding that, you know, that is his, you know, a remnant. It's is his body. Like I said, I've already had the sense of his spirit, you know, separating from that. But I mean, there's my son. There's, you know, the person that I've, you know, always, all my life, I just wanted to make sure that I was always there for, and I wanted to be with, you know, had made a point of just being physically present and active in his life from the start. And you know, there's a moment that. You know, that I couldn't be there. So as I said, if I were, I'm sure my son would be alive. I don't know. I might be dead, but you know, I was just I'm just looking at. You know, I remember my son. I was, you know, was there. I accompanied my son, you know, into this life, and would you know, be there in his last physical. You know, presence, his body's last moments here, but yeah, that's all. I just it's almost kind of like you're looking and you're seeing, you keep trying to see until you see, you know, what's not really there. You know, as if you could kind of look through it and see, you know, a different truth, a different reality. But yeah, it. I'm feeling for my young man that has suffered something that I know that he did not deserve to suffer.
And you're looking at him and you're seeing only from, ostensibly from his neck up or his shoulders up.
Yeah.
That's what you're seeing.
And on the other side of a window in a room where they have a closed door in which, as I said, I can detail this a little more, in which there's also a police officer, which was totally improper, an officer who admitted handled the body, which was improper. But I'm locked on the other side of this glass, and then they're still hiding his body mainly behind a curtain, and, you know, just have this this gurney pulled up to the glass just to where I can see, you know, basically from maybe about shoulder up. And it's,
so for purposes of... So for, in that instance, your main purpose then was simply to identify the body as that of your son. It wasn't meant for you to be any closer to him or anything like that. It was just a strict matter of for the purposes of identification.
As far as they were concerned, yeah.
After you identified your son and confirmed that, in fact, it was your son, when next did you see his body?
You're talking about during the same episode, or you mean following
after
that
the,
night? You mean
following that night?
Okay. Following that night.
Yes.
Following that night. I mean, when he's finally taken here, a place in Nashville handles autopsies for this region. So from Jackson, Tennessee, ultimately that's where Q's body was taken. So no, we don't see it again until we get it to the funeral home here in Jackson.
And in between these two times, did you have access to him at all in any way?
Well, the only thing that I got, and again, this was, you know, after, you know, that whole period of being there, and again, like I said, basically accompanied by this gang of white policemen, and I'm insisting that, you know, I want to, and at least, you know, lay hands, you know, on my son. They are just very fearful and protective. Like I said, obviously what they don't want me to discover at that moment. And I have to go on and on for a while in terms of, insisting on that. And then I'm finally told, you'll only be able to, you know, just hold this one hand, you know, touch any other part of the body or whatever, you know, all of, which is kind of peculiar, except when you understand what it is that they're, you know, trying to keep me from discovering about what they had done and, you know, what had happened. So, and that is, in the end, is essentially what I get to do. It's almost like, I mean, you know, only one hand, you know,
well,
one hand that I'm able to hold, yeah.
In a sense, it's kind of understandable, considering that at the time this is happening, for all intents and purposes, from the police definition of things, this is an active investigation. And it is quite possible the body itself is evidence, and the idea is not to have the contamination of evidence through, you know, the interaction even with a parent or a loved one, because it's in effect a kind of crime scene. The body is regarded as, I suppose, at that time.
Which is precisely why the police are not to be handling the body in any way, but it was always police in there present with the body. And even the ME, who was supposed to be responsible for the body until the coroner comes to deliver it to their site, this person was totally out of sight for no less than 20 or 25 minutes, roughly a half hour or so, in the time that I was there. But there was always a policeman or policemen in the room with my son's body. And as I said, even she admitted that they handled the body. This was improper. So you can say, I know all of the officialdom gets thrown at me or the parent, but here's what the police are getting away with in their attempt to, you know, cover themselves.
So you're in the middle of the worst turmoil anybody could go through, and your mind is racing, your heart is pounding, you are looking at a whole bunch of things unfolding. When do you begin? When does your brain start to kick in to this notion that you are in the middle of a huge problem here? And you begin to now take notes, not as a father alone, but as a citizen, a wise citizen, about something is beginning to happen here. You're making sense of the environment that you're in. And when do you begin to connect that the environment that you are in is telling you to be on guard?
Usually it's that, I'm not being flippant when I say that. That's probably, you know, when I set foot in Jackson, Tennessee. But as far as that night, even before I even reach my door, getting back to the place, I understand it. Because like I said, there's several cars outside, even though they don't come to my door until, you know, some minutes after I'm in the place. So that sense of guard is there, and what's happening then, to your question, is probably just this increased, heightening sense of what you're describing, because you're realizing, with each passing moment more and more, the extent of it more and more, where this is going, what this is about, where this is going to take you, where this is going to require you to go and do. That sense of guard was there, you know, probably long before my son was cut down by the police.
Okay. Well, we've covered quite a bit of ground today, and I want to thank you for, again, allowing us into this very intimate area of your life. But it is a great tragedy, and I know the spirit in which you are allowing us to do this is so that people can get an understanding of how, in very human terms, when we read these headlines and whatnot, this is what goes on behind the scenes in many, many cases, in too many cases, where people come up against a wall and they have to deal with it. This, we don't go to college to learn how to deal with these things. There are no courses in how to deal with these things. But in the moment, you have to be... You have to be so sharp. You have to be everything, and you're suffering incredibly all at the same time. We'll talk in our next chapter, if you will, and that is on Thursday. We will now talk about, you will disassemble for us the actual details of this incident that resulted in the death of Q. How did he die? What happened? And you're beginning now to dig deeper for answers. So that is our next chapter. But today, as we wrap up, in this initial phase of the experience, as you recount it, looking back, what do you think you, how do you see yourself in the way that you were able to handle the situation? How do you see yourself?
In my role of being Sinkew's father, I mean, if I understand your question, I mean, I just, it just something that comes without question. I mean, and that has never been a question for me in terms of, hey, he's my son, you know, I mean, his father, whatever is needed for me to do in his best interest. I mean, that is just what I do, just instinctively. That's how I still, you know, see what I'm doing now. And as I said before, I, you know, learned to, from the time of kindergarten, you know that don't fall into the trap of just blowing up, because that plays into their hands and takes you out of a position to do what you need to do. And I believe I've always been Sinkew's strongest advocate. So I definitely saw a need for that. you know, during that moment. That's how I see this. I'm really serving, you know, the interests of my son, who I know would appreciate his dad doing this, even though in his quiet and unassuming nature, he would frequently say, "Dad, you know, to take it easy, don't, you know, whatever." But and I would always tell him, "Just Q, you have to assert yourself. You have to take up for yourself, and not let people take advantage of you." I'm doing what is just natural, but I also, because like I said, I am an activist, a community activist, and have an interest in the well-being of my people. I see my son's this quest for justice on behalf of my son as part of a larger struggle. So it's in that, and I gladly place myself as a servant in that cause.
Lasana Jaspora, thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you for sharing this very intimate window into your life and the life of your son. Thank you so much. We will connect again on Thursday, and we will get into the deeper layers of this case. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
That brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it begins to shed some light on this particular case, but more broadly on the same journey that so many parents, many of them completely blindsided by the tragedies that occur in their lives, and that is the deaths of their children at the hands of police. The hope is that in telling the story, we get an appreciation of the impact, which is beyond the individual, him or herself, and the impact on family, the impact on community, and really the impact on society as well. Thank you so much. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. Coming up next, Economic Update with Richard Wolff. You can write me and let me know how this program appealed to you today. LeadStories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.
River fast, river slow, river knows I love. So